Welcome to Pharmaceutical Executives Leadership Series with corporate strategy expert Ken Banta. Ken is CEO of the Vanguard Network, the membership and consulting organization for C-suite executives. I'm Mike Christel, Group Managing Editor at MJH Life Sciences. In this episode, we are joined by Andy Milligan, founding partner at the Caffeine Partnership, the UK-based consultancy that advises leaders in several industries, including pharma, on brand-led strategy and customer experience. This discussion explores the evolving role of branding in the life sciences and the challenges companies face, how brands can effectively communicate their value proposition and engage customers, and that critical dynamic of trust in brand management, touching on the rare disease setting as an example.
When I was thinking about this ongoing podcast that we're doing, Andy, Michael, myself, and Pharma Executive in Vanguard, I thought, you know, this branding topic is really an interesting one, especially, you know, it's not so direct and obvious necessarily for some of the life science companies, but I think it's really fascinating. So anyway, we thought we'd do that, and thanks for joining.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Kicking off the segment, Andy and Ken, share from a fundamental perspective what they believe are the qualities of a powerful brand.
The fundamental quality that a great brand always has, and it's a difficult one for brands to maintain, is relevance to the consumer. When brands lose their way, one of the reasons they lose their way is because they become complacent and they don't move fast enough with where their customers or consumers are heading. So we've got great brands that I grew up with, like Kodak, just didn't move fast enough to where customers were going. There's nothing wrong fundamentally with the association of Kodak with memories, because memories were incredibly important to people. But there was, I think, a failure to maintain relevance to the way consumers were beginning to adapt and what they were expecting. And so relevance is key, but that comes back to consistency with a core set of values that people attribute to them. They transcend any single product or service manifestation, but they're kind of things like, yeah, that's what I get. That's what I like most about them. That's what I see in myself about them. That's what I've come to expect from them, that kind of quality, even though it's an entirely different product. IBM does nothing that it used to do in terms of products. I mean, it doesn't make a thing. You know, it used to make typewriters. It used to make computers. It doesn't make anything now. But people still associate IBM with something, with information solutions that will benefit mankind. And that core consistency is there. And then the consistency of the application of that brand identity over time, keeping it refreshed, that brand personality that is very, very important to customers, both in terms of being able to find the brand easily in the marketplace, recommend it, but also we like semiotics, we like signs, we like logos, we like colors, we're drawn to them. So again, being really clear that brand footprint, that brand identity is kept consistent. And those are two big things that I think most brands get right. And there are a couple of others, but I think if you can get that relevance and that consistency, and of course, the differentiation that necessarily evolves with that, you tend to have a strong brand.
I would echo all that, and maybe a part of that or another way of conveying some of that is the concept of trust, because all the things that Andy was talking about add up to a trusted relationship, and without trust, those other things don't really work, and you can be very consistent in a lot of wrong ways as well. So it's doing those things in a way that generates trust. And right now, nothing is more obvious about that than looking at the royal family in the UK. It's been a matter of years that things have unraveled, but one or two series of events have kind of destroyed that trust element in maybe a couple of years, or some would say a few weeks. The brand of Windsor is suddenly tarnished and very hard to repair. And I guess that's the other point that I think Andy was making, and so did Steve Jobs, which is that once you do damage your brand or destroy it, it's very hard to rebuild it or to recover. So a lot of good reasons for being a good keeper of it, and why
Absolutely.
it matters so much. Because also the irony of it all, or the paradox, is when it's a really well-known brand, it's great if you keep it up and you keep it moving. But if you mess with it, or if it starts to fail, then it's kind of a big catastrophe. That's kind of what we're seeing with that Windsor story
Yeah.
right now.
I think it's a really good point, Ken. Going back, one of the original purposes of a brand was trust. It was the guarantee of an origin. People would put their mark to a painting. That is a brand. That's Van Gogh, but in Van Gogh, you can trust it's come from me. The reason that trademark law was established and brand names were registered legally was again about trust. So you could trust this product. That was very important. The very first trademark ever registered in the world in 1875, I think, was a beer brand. The beer brand was Bass, and I've had a famous red triangle. I think you still get Bass beer somewhere in the States. But it's, knowing that what you're pouring down your throat can be trusted is very important. And I think it's so important now, Ken, because I think there is a big trust problem around. It's a combination of forces, including new technology, new communication channels, the ability of artificial intelligence to create deep fakes, all this sort of stuff. I don't want to get political, but across all of politics, there's always been a tendency for politicians to oversell, underdeliver. That erodes trust. And the royal family, to your point, was supposed to be perceived as above all that kind of stuff. Its brand was built around the integrity of its behavior. And when that gets damaged, as you say, it can be absolutely irrecoverable.
Interesting to get both of your thoughts from the pharma angle, maybe with your pharmaceutical clients. You mentioned trust. How are companies, or how would you advise companies in their approaches, in their brand engagement approaches, in connecting the science with the experience to create the trust message around the products? Is there anything that you're, any new approaches you're seeing or?
Well, one, let me start, and then Andy will
Yeah.
elaborate, I'm sure. You know, within the within this crazy world of bioscience, biopharma, you know, there are some rarefied elements, I would say. And one of them is that, you know, when you look at what people trust and what they don't trust, there's a real paradox, because people tend to trust early research scientists and early science, you know, before it's commercialized. They think that's fabulous. And, you know, biotechnology always gets pretty high ratings of trust, you know, the lab things happening, new molecules. But then the commercialization of those things, which, as we all know, is essential to actually getting them to people, suddenly becomes very suspect. And the idea that health then and wellness are connected with cost and paying for things becomes something that people have a lot of trouble emotionally and, you know, kind of morally in some ways, and they can't put the two together. And so I think, you know, one of the biggest battles that these companies that are in a commercial phase, or are commercial organizations like a Pfizer, a Merck, a Lilly, is that they're constantly dealing with this tension between wellness and cost and value and who pays. And, you know, the public view is generally that these things should be free, essentially. And yet everyone knows, including the consumer, when they're thinking separately, that these things cost billions of dollars to create. So what's the way it's supposed to work? And then, you know, another, you know, kind of theory that doesn't work is you put it in the hands of the state. You have someone like, you know, Russia creating things for the people. And what we've seen, of course, is that that's a colossal failure. It's worse than nothing. But to reconcile those things is very difficult. So I think that's what these large companies are often trying to do, is to figure out how to get people to accept that, you know, there's a value benefit equation, a cost benefit equation to these things. And unfortunately, when you come to health, that's something very few people are willing to do. They're fine with that when it's a car. They're fine with that even when it, to some degree, when it's education. But when it comes to these health areas, it's really just, no one's really cracked the code on that one, I don't think. And when companies seem to have done it, they then get into serious trouble, because someone uncovers the fact that they're actually, for example, charging more in the United States for the same product than they do in Europe. That's slightly a commercial decision, but that's also a balancing of resources decision. But again, that starts to undermine that trust that we were talking about again. So it's a really tough challenge. By contrast, I think when it's a smaller innovative company that is selling, essentially developing and then selling its innovation to a larger company, that's a different story. And I think, for example, I'm working with a couple smaller companies like that now, and they actually have a much clearer pathway to what they need to do. The interesting thing with them is they may think that branding is not really important to them because all they need to do is create, scientific molecules, biological molecules, and that is their brand. And I think that's not really the case. And it's also not a very smart position to take when you're looking at getting funding, because if no one knows who you are and why you exist and what makes you special, then you're going to have a tougher time when you go in to a company like Merck to say, you need to buy our molecule. And that's, to me, really one of the fascinating things about this sector.
Yeah, it's fascinating, Ken. It's such a complex area, as you say, health. And, over here in Europe, of course, we have a broadly socialized, as you call it in the States, medical system.
Yep.
And therefore, there are certain guardians or gatekeepers, which is your general practitioner, your GP over here, who play a lot of the role of the ambassador of trust. So you go to see your GP, and if your GP says you want to be on X, you'll trust them and you'll take them a prescription. But I know this is something that was really a problem when I was working with pharmaceutical companies, was there was another layer of trust problem beneath that, was a patient may take the prescription, but then would fail to comply with it because even though they trusted the doctor to be giving them the right medicine, they didn't necessarily think that they need to take all the pills all the time in the right way. So a lot of work was then done on trying to get patients, sorry, by pharmaceutical companies and healthcare providers, to get them to trust the regimen, because the health impact on it for the individual would be higher, and of course the health impact for the NHS, for the country, and of course the company choosing the pharmaceuticals itself would improve. So and then you have this issue between, I think, what people are more untrusting of things they put into the body or on the body. So so if you go in for an MRI scan, you go in for a C scan, these are, I don't think people have the same trust issues with those as they do with medication, with drugs.
With the matter of whether it's cost or investment or whatever the right, the different words are around medicine and health in Europe, pretty much equally with the US, the level of trust in large so-called pharmaceutical brands is actually very similar, which is bad. In other words, the trust level of Merck in America and the US Merck in Europe, let alone the German Merck, they're all lumped together. It's kind of fascinating that in Europe, for example, in the UK, I think in principle, people are receiving, a lot of them are receiving their medication through the national systems. The cost they're paying is relatively low, but that's true in the US as well. Most people in America are not paying the cost of their medicines. They're paying a copay, which is basically what happens across Europe now in various ways. And yet people still, they see it as they know that the total cost to society is very large and they don't accept that. And they don't believe that, their taxes should be going to pay for American companies making pharmaceuticals. They should be free or virtually. And there's just zero, or very, not maybe zero, but pretty little correlation in people's thinking about, if I pay for a new car, I fully understand that, 80% of that is going to making it a better car. I'm getting a better car because someone else paid more, or I'm paying for innovation. But paying for innovation in healthcare is like just not a very good brand position to take, to go out there saying, my brand is different because you really ought to be paying for it. It's worth it. Not a great message. And the other issue, too, on trust that I think is also unfortunate is that the trusted intermediary, a doctor, used to be really trusted. Now that trust relationship is diminishing, maybe, Andy, because they are kind of on the delivery end of health things, which people don't fully understand or accept. That element of not even trusting your general GP or your local doctor. Trust them more than you trust a company, but sometimes not a whole lot more. And you definitely don't trust that health system that they're part of. I mean, the NHS used to be the gold-plated health delivery system. Now, unfortunately, it's not doing great either because of issues with cost and delivery and trustworthiness, right? So it's a really complicated area. And I think, too, that the other aspect of the trust piece in healthcare is that people really don't understand this stuff. And that sort of goes to the fact that the levels of scientific literacy are appalling in most places. But you could argue that the companies and the sectors that are involved in this don't do enough to educate people about what's actually happening. So it's a black box, and people don't like black boxes, especially if they hear that the very acceptable rate of like 1 in a million people having a problem turns into a political attack on the company or the product.
And think we also don't really want to think too much about it, our healthcare either. So it's not one of these lovely discretionary purchases that will make me feel good and feel great to be out and about. And I'm sure that sort of adds to some of the issues around it, but it is fascinating. I think one of the things, this is my personal perspective, I couldn't say this is based on any huge studies, but I'm a trustee of a rare diseases charity. And a lot of the things we push for include repurposing of drugs. Now, rare diseases are not that particularly interesting to pharmaceutical companies because they're rare. So there ain't a big market in them individually. But collectively, there are a lot of people who suffer from different rare diseases. And some of these rare diseases are on the same genetic pathways as more well-known, more widespread diseases. The reason I say this is because one of the interesting things we push for a lot is patient advocacy and getting patients to be able to stand, lobby for themselves, to get more awareness about the diseases and get the scientific community and the pharmaceutical community interested in them. And I think actually, pharmaceuticals tend to be more science and commercialization focused than they are fundamentally on the patient as customer or consumer. And so there's less interest found over time in what do these patients actually feel or think or want or what's the experience, so that we can offer more than just a drug, but we can offer perhaps more of an ecosystem of support around for them. And I think that might be. If perhaps pharmaceutical companies leaned more into the experience that people have with those conditions, not just the medication, maybe a way for them to kind of start to build trust up, because you're showing an interest in them as human beings suffering from a condition, rather than somebody's getting a drug from you.
Are developers perhaps missing an opportunity in the rare disease segment in the way they brand? Should leaders think about branding a little bit differently with these sort of drugs, creating a strategic approach where they're aligning with communities, like a bridge between patient communities, between their development efforts, and then down the line, business value? Is there a different way they can think about that whole journey?
Yeah, I personally think so. And yet, it obviously is not very easy to do because, there's an endless parade of people who are, advising or proposing or otherwise trying to work out that linkage and, frankly, create what Andy was talking about in terms of consistency and brand message and values. And yet, there often seems to be a kind of disconnect in how also these companies operate. And it seems a tough one to get that consistency because, you have fundamentally sales operations that are selling product to doctors or to health systems, and they're doing that in a very different fashion than the doctor wishes to convey the value of the product to the patient. And then you also have, message happening all the time, including in rare disease, where essentially the provider says, unfortunately, I or our system can't afford to get you that drug because it's too expensive. So sorry about that. And that happens, for example, in the UK and in the US, but in the UK, it's very visible with the NHS. If you're a private pay patient, you may get a treatment that your neighbor across the street will not get through the NHS. And adding to all that, the same specialist who's treating the private pay patient is going to be possibly treating the NHS-based patient. And I have a friend of mine who had a very serious form of melanoma, and he could not get that through the NHS. And yet he knew his own provider said, I wish you were a private pay patient here because then we could supply you. So in the end, he went to Amsterdam and had a different system involved. But that kind of disconnect is beyond any one patient or provider to solve for, but it's a fundamental problem in the way that this consistency element comes across.
Yeah, that's interesting because you think of rare disease, storytelling is a huge element, right, in that space. Is it as simple as that these companies have to be better at telling that the story, kind of outlining the purpose, around these drugs and these diseases? Yeah.
I think there's something in that, Michael. I really do. I think, and again, I don't want to make these comparisons, seem too pat. But I've always thought that one of the challenges in pharmaceutical marketing, but medical marketing generally, is too much messaging. And I think that's probably because in a simple old style format, and it used to be magazines, they're probably trying to get as much messaging to as many different stakeholders in the one ad. It's got this message for a GP, it's got this message for the purchaser or healthcare provider, it's all that this message was regulated. And I think the inability to have simple, clear, and usually emotive messaging is one of the things that kind of undermines trust. Because I think to have trust in the first place, you've got to know what is the story this person trying to tell me. I can't trust anything if I don't know what it is, Or obviously, it's a highly regulated industry. It's a highly compliant industry. There's a lot of legal scrutiny for very good reasons. But so is the financial services industry. I think the financial services industry has begun to do a much better job in its storytelling than it ever did before, and has moved away from trying to tell you 15 different things about, this bond tracker will do for the EU plus five different caveats at the bottom, and sort of honed in on some very simple, powerful storytelling, which draws a customer, consumer in. And then it's up to the brand to deliver against that story. And I think that's one of the challenges in pharmaceutical marketing, medical marketing, is there's so many messages for so many different stakeholders, and there's a limited amount of media, so you kind of throw it all in there a bit, and then it's difficult. I think patients are the last people who are considered in that storytelling, I think. But I have seen some fantastic examples of where I think people have found there is can be an emotional connection between a GP who recognizes and sees a serious repeated problem and also empathetically feels some of the pain that some of the patients are going through. Rare diseases are a good example of that because those rare diseases are often very, very difficult to live with diseases. And the people who are suffering from them can often feel very isolated. And I think that is, and GPs don't know how to treat them. And so there is a kind of almost empathy of isolation. Do you know what I mean? And it's easier, I think, to have a more powerful story among, and that cuts to your point, Michael, makes a bridge across the community. But that's a personal observation.